Welcome to Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson, inviting you to explore ideas about how you can enjoy a better way of life from one of today's top experts in quantum consciousness. Cynthia Sue Larson is a life coach and the best-selling author of Quantum Jumps, Reality Shifts, High Energy Money, and Aura Healing Meditations, who has been publishing the free monthly Reality Shifters e-zine since 1999 through realityshifters.com. Living the Quantum Dream with Cynthia Sue Larson is part of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Sue Larson, and our guest today is John Kramer. John G. Kramer is a professor emeritus of physics at the University of Washington in Seattle, who served as director of the University of Washington Nuclear Physics Laboratory. John is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and of the American Physical Society, was chair of the APS DNP Nuclear Science Resources Committee, and served on the APS panel on public affairs. He presently serves on the external counsel of the NIAC Innovative Projects Program of NASA. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so very, very honored to have you on the show. And your new book, The Quantum Handshake, presents your transactional interpretation for quantum physics. You published a paper introducing this interpretation in 1986, which I found compelling for its inclusion of the notion of a kind of handshake through time. Would you provide us with a summary of what your book and the transactional interpretation is all about?
Okay, first of all, in quantum mechanics, there's a thing called the wave function. And if you look at the mathematics of quantum mechanics, you find that the wave function and its complex conjugate appear equally in various places in the mathematics. The transactional interpretation interprets the complex conjugate of the wave function as being the mirror image of the wave function, which is moving backwards in time, and it represents quantum events as being a handshake between the wave function and its complex conjugate, the so-called advance and retarded waves. These ideas came from a work by Wheeler, John Wheeler and Richard Feynman, published in 1945, which was trying to do something with electrodynamics using more or less the same ideas. And I came across it when I was a graduate student, and many years later, it occurred to me that that their ideas could be applied to quantum mechanics. So the book basically lays out the history of quantum mechanics and this idea of transactions as the sort of key element that's been missing in understanding what's going on in quantum mechanics. And it explains all the paradoxes and peculiar situations that one finds in quantum mechanics.
Wonderful. Well, this is a big deal that you're bringing the book out at this time. It's a book I've been waiting for literally for, years. So, and I don't think I'm the only one. So those of us who have been just sitting waiting for you to, bring something together, much more than just a research paper, are delighted. And I was wondering if you could tell us what did inspire you to bring out your book, The Quantum Handshake, at this time?
I retired from teaching, or more or less retired from teaching in 2010 at the University of Washington. I taught one quarter for 5 years after that. But I had intended to start writing the book then. In fact, I did some work on it. And then I got distracted by a problem I was working on involving whether you could use the entanglement that's present in quantum mechanics for sending signals. There were certain experiments where you could switch on and off an interference pattern remotely, essentially. You could do something on one side of the table and the interference pattern on the other side of the table would go away. And this looked for all the world like you could send a signal non-locally, which would be very important because you could send it faster than light and backwards in time and so forth. And I couldn't see what would prevent that. And after about 5 years of research, I now understand the showstopper, the way quantum mechanics prevents this from happening. And this sort of cleared the path for me to write the book. And there's a chapter on non-local signaling as part of the book.
Wow. So I remember that you had sought some crowdfunding. This is even before Kickstarter was a big phenomenon that it has become. And I'd love if you feel comfortable talking about some of that, because I think people may have seen you in the newspaper.
Yeah, I got some publicity I didn't exactly want. The time to publicize an experiment is after you have experimental results, not when you're thinking about starting it. But I gave a talk at a meeting in San Diego in 2007, I guess. And there was a reporter from New Scientist, the British science magazine there, and he wrote up my talk. And and then a reporter from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper came around to see me, and I told him about the experiment I was doing and the fact that I had reached the point where I couldn't go any further because I had done all I could with the resources I had available. And so he wrote it up in the newspaper, and the next thing I know, people were calling me asking if they could contribute and fund the research. It wasn't something I sort of ginned up myself. It just sort of happened. And there was a lot of publicity about it simply because the prospect of sending messages backwards in time excites people. And so I got about $40,000 and was able to do the next phase of the experiment. And it led to this result, I say. And I now understand more about how the interplay of non-locality in such a way that quantum mechanics prevents you from sending the kind of signals I was interested in.
That is interesting, and I'd love to hear more about that. And for people who are just recognizing that this sounds a bit strange, because a lot of people listening might not be so knowledgeable about quantum mechanics, the point of my show is to open this area of interest up for everybody, because I feel like this is going to be a field that will be taught in regular primary schools at some point coming soon. So I want people to feel not so intimidated by the subject. And I think seeing you with, I think, was that a DeLorean car in the newspaper?
Yeah, yes. they had a photographer who was hired to take a picture of me for a magazine article. And he found some guy who had a DeLorean, and they had me sitting in the DeLorean as one of the pictures they used in the magazine, which, you know, has sort of Back to the Future implications. And so therefore, I guess it was appropriate. It was the only time I've ever been in a DeLorean. So it wasn't my car.
Oh, I loved it. And I think that this is the kind of silly thing that you might find it annoying. And certainly when you're doing science, the last thing in the world you want is lots of publicity when you're still working on experimental design and seeing if the experimental apparatus is even going to work. But on the bright side, you got some amazing support early on. And I think even before there was Kickstarter, you had definitely found supporters. And that's phenomenal. And as you say, it's quite a testimony to your research and the fact that people, there's, I think this whole idea of science fiction is appealing. This idea, can you communicate? And you said that based on this recent foray into the scientific experiment, you noticed that you've found there seem to be some limitations, perhaps intrinsic to quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Seem to prevent this kind of communication. Could you talk about that?
Yes. basically, what one is doing is you have an experiment that has two photons involved, and these photons are entangled, and there are tricky ways that are available now for making pairs of entangled photons. And if you make a certain kind of measurement on one of these photons, you can cause it to either behave like a particle or to behave like a wave. And if you cause it to behave like a wave, you get an interference pattern. And if you cause it to behave like a particle, you get no interference pattern. And so that looked like a switchable interference pattern where you could do something to photon A and it would have an effect on photon B. So it looked for all the world like a signal. The trouble is that when you do such a measurement on the photon, the measurement has two results, and the guy on the other end of the experiment doesn't know which of those results you measured. And it turns out that one of these measurements produces an interference pattern, and the other measurement result produces an anti-interference pattern. And since you don't know which result would happen, you have to add both together. And when you add them together, the interference pattern goes away. And that's the way nature blocks the signals that would otherwise allow you to send messages backwards in time or faster than light or instantaneously or whatever you want to call it.
So this is kind of like trying to play chess with nature and try to see if we can break the ultimate codes.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable. Well, it's quite
a... And I said there's a chapter in my book that describes this in considerable detail. And there's even a little theorem that we were able to prove showing where this comes out and comes in quantum mechanics. And it seems to be an important part of the mathematics. It's with no way around it.
Well, thanks for bringing the subject back to your book. It is a remarkable book, and I think it's perfect for people listening to the show that might know nothing about science, thanks to the fact that you have the most entertaining and most wonderfully thorough introduction to the field of quantum mechanics in the first section of the book. So it's worth it right there, and I really do want to encourage people to get more knowledgeable about what's going on. And then for physicists who are really desiring to know how does this theory, this interpretation, stand up to a lot of the concerns, there are a number of appendices in the back that are quite good at getting into that detail.
Yeah, well, actually, the appendices in the back, some of them are aimed at the sort of introductory level. They're for people who don't understand the mathematics of quantum mechanics or what it is. There's this sort of a little short thing in the back showing what quantum mechanics is, what wave functions are, how they interact, and so forth. And there's also a very extensive question and answer thing where some simple and some rather complicated questions about the transactional interpretation are asked and answered.
And I think it's a credit to you as a professor for so many years that you know how to introduce the subject matter. And I must say, it's a quite entertaining way. I don't think I've ever been so entertained and amused while reading a book because it's funny. You know, at least it was to me. So I really love it. And then there's a quote included in your book, The Quantum Handshake. And this is by physicist Richard Feynman, who sums up the situation neatly when he states, "One might still like to ask, how does it work? What is the machinery behind the law? No one has found any machinery behind the law. No one can explain any more than we have just explained. No one will give you any deeper representation of the situation. We have no idea about a more basic mechanism from which these results can be deduced." Now, he's talking, of course, about quantum mechanics and the fact that for so many years it seems to work pretty well when physicists shut up and calculate. But for those of you, definitely including yourself in this, who are looking deeper to find that understanding of what's going on behind the math, how can we know when we've succeeded in the seemingly impossible quest for a winning interpretation for quantum physics?
Yes. I think I understand the answer to the question Feynman was asking, which is what's behind the what is the mechanism behind the mathematics? And I think I now understand what the mechanism is behind the mathematics, and I've done my best to explain it to anybody who's interested in learning about it.
Right. And so, Mike, there are lots of interpretations for people just tuning in. They don't know what I'm talking about. Of course, there are things like the Copenhagen interpretation. There's holographic interpretations. Many people nowadays are hearing all these different versions of multiverse theories. So what we're talking about today is this transactional interpretation. And I know you're not, of course, unprejudiced or unbiased. You definitely feel like this is the right one. But how would you know when we have found the right one? I love the way in your book you're basically going through all of the critics and the various attempts to punch holes in the transactional interpretation theory, interpretation itself. So what gives you that feeling of we know we've got a winner because...
Now, first of all, let me say a little about interpretations. There's a story I used in the book, which is that there was a small child who was growing up in a house that was owned by the Burlett School of Languages, and everybody in the house spoke a different language to him. His mother spoke to him as English, his father in French, the guy down the hall spoke in German, the guy across the hall spoke in Turkish, and so forth. And so one day the little boy started talking gibberish, and his mother and father worked on him for about an hour trying to get him to talk something sensible. And he finally explained that he thought he was getting to be a pretty big boy and that now he thought it was high time that he had a language of his own. And I'm afraid the situation in quantum mechanics is much the same way. Since there's no way you can test an interpretation to find out whether it's good or bad, this way you can do it on most physics theories, this has opened the door for many, many, many people to invent their own partial interpretations of quantum mechanics. Usually they focus on one or two puzzles and answer them without answering the whole thing. My feeling is that the way you evaluate an interpretation is, A, whether it solves all the problems of quantum mechanics and not just a few of them, and B, whether it's economical, whether you have to make wild additional assumptions, or whether you have to make fewer assumptions than the other theories. The transactional interpretation has the advantage that the Born probability rule, the idea that when you take the wave function and its complex conjugate as a product, this gives you a probability, is implicit in the interpretation, and you don't have to make a separate assumption about it as you do in the Copenhagen interpretation and all the other interpretations of quantum mechanics. So as philosophers would say, this makes it more economical than the others because it involves fewer independent assumptions in order to set it up. The other thing is that it explains all of the paradoxes in quantum mechanics. There's not any one thing in quantum mechanics that remains unexplained in terms of the various puzzles and Schrodinger's cats and Wheeler's delayed choice experiments and so forth that have puzzled people for most of the last century.
That's a great segue. I'd love to take a look at this Schrodinger's cat thought experiment. This is something some people do know about. And you mentioned in the Quantum Handshake that when people have thought about that famous experiment involving the cat, that there's been some confusion regarding the wrong question being asked.
Right.
And so rather than asking when the wave function collapses, we'd be better off asking how it collapses.
Yes.
So I'd love it if you would elaborate on this, if you could summarize the Schrodinger's cat experiment for people who don't know what it is.
Well, first of all, let me start with Schrodinger. He was one of the founders of quantum mechanics, but he was he thought he understood what quantum mechanics was because he thought that the wave functions that were coming out of his equation were very much like the wave functions that come out of electromagnetism. And Bohr and Heisenberg were able to disabuse him of this idea by showing him what the various peculiarities of quantum mechanics were, which sort of torpedoed that picture. But he spent the rest of his life sort of complaining about and criticizing quantum mechanics. He never accepted the Copenhagen interpretation. And one of his ways of illustrating the problems with quantum mechanics was by hypothesizing a situation in which you take a cat and put it in an absolutely isolated box for an hour. And in the box is a Geiger counter near a radioactive source, which is made very weak so that it has the probability of 50% of making one click in the Geiger counter in a period of an hour. And the Geiger counter is connected to a hammer that smashes a flask of prussic acid, which is a deadly poison, which would kill the cat. So the experimentalist sets this situation up, and then after an hour, opens the box to see whether the cat is alive or dead. And the question is, what is the wave function of the cat and the time between the time when the experiment is set up and the time when the box is open? And the sort of way that quantum mechanics is normally applied, you would say that the wave function of the cat is half alive and half dead, because until you make the measurement on the by opening the box, the observer has no knowledge of what the state of the cat is, and the wave function, according to the Copenhagen interpretation, represents the observer's state of knowledge. Okay, there are two things wrong with this. One of them is that in the transactional interpretation, the wave function is not a representation of the observer's state of knowledge. The correspondence between the observer's state of knowledge and the wave function is an accident. It's not central to the idea of the wave function. And secondly, there is a transaction somewhere during the process in which the Geiger counter either produces the thing and smashes the flask, producing one kind of transaction, or it doesn't, producing a different kind of transaction. And there's never a time where the wave function, where the cat is in a mixed state where it's half alive and half dead.
Oh, thank you. And I think that was the whole point Schrodinger was trying to make, is this looks ludicrous. And so and you're able to reassure Schrodinger, almost many years later, he's not alive anymore, but to give reassurance to people who have similar concerns.
Interestingly, Schrodinger had a very important impact on molecular biology. He basically deduced that there must be something like DNA a long time before anybody had discovered what it was. And so in some of the books on molecular biology, they quote, they praise Schrodinger for his talk at Edinburgh, which ended up in a book called What is Life, in which he was deducing that DNA has to be there because there has to be something like that for evolution to work.
Right. Actually, that's quite cogent, and I'm glad you brought that up. I did actually interview John Joe McFadden recently, and he was referencing that same book by Schrodinger and referencing the fact that apparently looks like we're getting some quantum activity in DNA itself. And so what's extraordinary and very exciting, and the reason I'm doing this radio show right now, is that we're reaching a point in time when quantum cosmologists, quantum information theorists, quantum biologists, and then, of course, quantum physicists are coming forward with a lot more information than we've ever had before, and things are getting pretty exciting.
Yes, and one of these days we're going to have quantum computers, and that's going to change everything.
That is right. That's requiring that we finally back up a little bit and get back to what you're doing, which I love, which is this, it's really the philosophy of the science. It's what's going on underneath. What is the interpretation? What can we take a look? And as you say so clearly, find is the most economical explanation that has the fewest assumptions to it that would clearly explain what we're seeing when we look at quantum behavior. So thank you for that. And then some of the more interesting recent physics experiments study retrocausality. We're talking about the DeLorean and time travel and all that. Let's come back to that a little bit, because this is that influence of future events on situations from the past. And I'd love if you could describe a little bit about so-called delayed choice experiments and what they're able to show us about the nature of reality.
Yeah, John Wheeler is perhaps the most famous physicist who never won a Nobel Prize during his life, but he was a pioneer in certain aspects of quantum mechanics, plus general relativity and so forth. And he was the person who named black holes in the first place, and he devised an experiment, which is that there's a famous experiment done by Thomas Young in the early 1800s, which first demonstrated the wave nature of light. You take, I guess Young used sunlight or something. Anyway, you run it through a couple of pinholes, and you allow the light emerging from the two pinholes to sort of overlap with one another. And when you do, you see a so-called interference pattern. There are places where it reinforces and gives you a very intense region, and there are places where it cancels and gives you a dark region. So you can see this dark and light pattern called an interference pattern on the backside of two slits that have light going through. It works better if you use a single wavelength, but you can actually use visible light at a certain level. This is a well-known effect. And basically, if you interpret it as photons going through, each photon, you can do this at such a low level that only one photon at a time goes through the two slits. And you would think that that prevents there from being an interference pattern, because a photon must have to choose whether it goes through slit A or slit B. But if you actually do the experiment, you find that even when you do it one photon at a time, you still get the interference pattern. Somehow the photon is going through both slits and making the interference pattern. Now, Wheeler had the idea that that's causing light to have wave-like behavior, but you can also cause light to have particle-like behavior by focusing, using a lens that makes an image of each of the slits and putting a photon detector at the image points. So he said, okay, so we set up a two-slit experiment, we put a screen up, and the light makes an interference pattern, or we put the screen down and the light continues through the lens to the detectors, and behaves like a particle. So we can cause it to behave either like a particle that goes through one slit at a time, or like a wave which goes through both slits at a time. Now, the trick is you choose a graduate student that has very fast reflexes, and you tell him to wait until after the light has gone through the slits before you decide whether the screen is up or down. So if before you decide whether the light photon is allowed to go through only one slit or whether it's allowed to go through both. And he hypothesized that if you did this experiment, you would find exactly what you expect, namely that you still see the interference pattern, even if you delay the choice of what measurement to make until after the photon must have already committed itself by going through one slit or two. So this is an example of retrocausality, because the decision you make at a later time influences the behavior of the photon at an earlier time. You can cause the photon by deciding to use the lens and the detectors to go through only one of the two slits, or you can cause the photon by using the screen to go through both of the slits, and you can do this after the photon has already passed through the slits. And so you're basically, your decision is reaching backwards in time and causing the photon to do one of the two behaviors.
And it's worth taking a moment to really emphasize this is for real. This is not theory. It's not conjecture.
No. It's done in the laboratory several times.
Right.
And Wheeler made the point even before it had been done at the laboratory that you could argue that, well, nobody has reaction times fast enough to make that decision and do that. He said, well, consider the light from a quasar. It goes through a foreground, it goes by, past a foreground galaxy and gets deflected, gravitationally deflected so that you can see the light from a quasar going around both sides of a galaxy and interfering. And so you can do the same measurement with light from a quasar, and you have millions or perhaps billions of years to make your decision before the light gets there, and you can reach back in time by a billion years and cause the light to go through a given photon to go around one side of the galaxy or to go around both sides of the galaxy. So yeah, he made the point that even in his initial foray that there's no issue of how fast the reaction time is.
And you're talking about John Wheeler here, right?
Yes.
And I agree with you. He was really ahead of his time, if I can use that. We're definitely at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I had a phone conversation with him when I first wrote the transactional interpretation paper. I sent him a copy of it, and then I had a phone conversation with him trying to convince him that this was the way to look at things. And he was very interested over a period of a long time, but he never quite was able to bite the bullet and say, yes, this is the right way to do it.
Right, and that gets back to why you brought your book out now, The Quantum Handshake, because you've had a chance to go through and take a look at a lot of the concerns, questions, and various things that people, quantum physicists, have brought up. So, and you do a great job with the book, the latter part of the book especially, addressing ways that the transactional interpretation does explain some really interesting quantum physics experiments that often have been brought up as kind of mind benders, like what's going on here?
Right.
And so I was wondering what your selection criteria was for choosing which of these experiments to include. There are so many, but you pick some really fascinating ones. And which experiments is the transactional interpretation especially good at explaining?
Well, for one thing, it explains the delayed choice experiment very nicely just by having this quantum handshake, which reaches backwards in time, and therefore it doesn't matter when the decision is made about when to do things. But in the 1970s, 1972, I believe, Friedman and Clauser did the first so-called Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, in which they effectively demonstrated that quantum mechanics is non-local. And a peculiar thing happened then. Rather than accepting that quantum mechanics is non-local and proceeding, various, you might call them quantum lawyers, came out of the woodwork and described various loopholes that could be some sort of improbable scenarios that might be going on that would make quantum mechanics still preserve it as its locality. And physicists have spent, I don't know, decades closing one loophole after another. And I really think this is wasted effort. I think it was pretty obvious from the Friedman-Clauser experiment that quantum mechanics was non-local, and the physics community should have accepted this and moved on, figuring out ways of using it and exploring it. And instead, there's been this massive effort to close loopholes. And I think the work might have been done better. So in my book, I sort of complain about this, and I don't talk about loophole closers at all. I focus on experiments that seem to show paradoxical behavior of one kind or another, and which various people have said there's no, none of the interpretations of quantum mechanics can explain this, and I explained it. And in cases where many of the other interpretations in quantum mechanics attempted to explain such things and failed.
Right. I really appreciate that. And you also added a concept later in the book of hierarchy to the transactional interpretation. And this is in response to a particular Gedanken experiment by Maudlin. And to summarize, in Maudlin's thought experiment, real sources in the quantum optics laboratory do not emit single particles on command. So there's always a non-zero probability that no particles at all will be emitted by the source, which means that either of the two experimental detectors might detect a photon, or there might be no photon detected at all. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how hierarchy plays a role, why it's needed, and what's going on there.
Yeah, Mark did his PhD thesis in part based on this Gedanken experiment. It's basically you have slow particles like maybe electrons or neutrons going off in two directions, and one of them has a detector that's close, and the other one has a place where there could be a detector, but it's far away. And if you detect a photon in the close detector, that's it. But if you don't, then the other detector swings around and goes to the place where it will detect the other particle going in the other direction. I think I didn't say this right. I guess you emit a single particle, but it can go equally well in both directions. And so you either detect it with a close detector on the right, or you swing around the detector on the left and produce it. And his point was that there could not be any competition by wave functions because the second detector wasn't there unless the first detector didn't detect it. He was partly sort of he also made some arguments about probabilities, and his probability arguments are wrong because he was assuming the Copenhagen idea that the wave function represents the knowledge of an investigator and therefore has to change in midstream if the knowledge changes. That's not the way quantum mechanics actually works, but that was what he was assuming in making probability arguments. But he did have a point about the other idea, and so the fix for this in a transactional interpretation is to assume that the decision of whether the wave function is collapsed by detecting the near particle is made first, and you either decide that there's a detection or no detection, and then the decision for whether it's detected by the second detector is made after that. So there's a hierarchy in which the close elements which are close in space-time have to be decided before the elements that are further away in space-time. And this is sort of interesting because it means the whole future time structure of the universe is built into this decision process for a single quantum event. So it's a sort of a microcosm of the future universe, which is an idea that sort of tickles my imagination.
It is interesting. And it also, for people who aren't familiar with what's going on with these detectors, most people know what it's like to throw a ball for a dog. And to me, this comes to mind for some reason. Like you might be throwing, playing fetch with your dog, and you've got your ball in your hand. And if you don't throw it close enough, the dog looks around. It doesn't see where the ball went. It's not right in front of it. So then it decides you must have really, pulled your arm back and thrown it long, so then it would go look long. There's always a third possibility. You didn't throw it at all. You're trying to fake the dog out, and you're holding
right.
It. So, and I like that.
Yeah, Maudlin didn't consider the third possibility, namely that there's no emission at all. And so that's where he partly went wrong.
Right. And I love how you bring that up in your book. And then you include mention of Lucian's Hardy's single atom interaction free Gedanken experiment. Now, this is a different thought experiment.
Yeah, it's not. It's one that would be very hard to do in practice, actually. Yeah.
Right. It seems like it's going to stay a thought experiment, but it's fascinating because, and I think there's a great growing interest in that particular one. Hardy is, a lot of people love the way he's thinking about these things. Could you briefly summarize how this experimental design works and explain how the transactional interpretation works in this setting?
Yeah, this is hard because it's a very fairly complicated experiment. There's a kind of arrangement called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer where take a photon and put a mirror and send it on two paths and then bring it around two different sides of a square and then recombine the photons at the other side. And when you recombine them, the photon can either go in the same direction it was going in the first place or going at 90 degrees to that. And if the path lengths of the two paths are exactly the same, then it always goes in the same direction it was going. But if there's something that causes the photon to fail to be there in one of the paths, it goes in both, it goes with equal probability in both directions. So there's a sort of a dark direction and a light direction. And Hardy's experiment involves looking in the dark direction when you have a single atom that can either be in the path of the photon or out of the path of the photon, depending on its spin orientation. And it turns out that you can learn something about the spin of the atom, even though the photon that you detect never interacted with the atom at all because it went along the other path. And this is a fairly paradoxical experiment, but it turns out that applying the quantum mechanics transactions to both transactions involving the photon and transactions involving the atom, you can easily explain the experimental results you expect to come out of this as predicted by quantum mechanics. There's no problem with quantum mechanics explaining what's going on here, but in terms of the words you put to what the role the atom plays in the experiment, it gets rather complicated, and the transactional interpretation is able to sort this out. There are elaborations of this, which instead of using one atom, you use two or three or four atoms and put them in various places. And Elitzer and his colleague have explored these and produced some very bizarre situations that are hard to explain with any other interpretation of quantum mechanics except the transactional interpretation.
I think this is quite interesting, and it also tends to back up the belief of many quantum information theorists right now that there is no return to classical reality. We really need to move forward, as you've been saying for so long.
Yeah, well, the question is whether reality is out there at all, and some people are willing to give up on reality, but I'm not. I think reality may be a little more complicated than we think, but it's still out there.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You actually start off in your book describing that you are very much a roll up the sleeves, get involved, and that's obvious from that latest experiment, the apparatus you were building and ran through that crowdfunded project for the last few years. So why do you have that strong belief that there is a reality out there? And, obviously it's anybody could choose one way or the other, but what appeals to you about that?
Well, what distinguishes me from most of the experiment of the people who have ventured to make interpretations of quantum mechanics is that I'm an experimentalist. I learned how to use quantum mechanics in my early career in doing nuclear physics and making measurements and then using quantum mechanics to predict what we're measuring and so forth. And the Copenhagen interpretation tells you that the wave function is not really out there in three-dimensional space. It's in the mind of the observer and it represents his state of knowledge. In applying quantum mechanics to nuclear physics, we never thought of the wave function as being in anybody's mind. We thought of them as waves moving through space and interacting with nuclei and so forth. So I have this prejudice that reality is out there and we just have to understand how it works. And so this is the point that I'm coming from. When I was a graduate student, I learned about the Wheeler-Feynman experiment because I pushed one of my professors about advanced waves, and he told me to go read the paper. And then about 20 or 30 years later, I was giving a lecture at the University of Washington about quantum mechanical paradoxes when it suddenly occurred to me that the Wheeler-Feynman ideas fitted in with the problems, and that you could use Wheeler and Feynman to explain what was going on in the quantum world. And that's where the transactional interpretation came from.
Somehow it had been overlooked all that time. I think that's really interesting that there you are in your college classroom looking at the chalkboard and you have this epiphany, and somehow everybody else in the room just didn't see it. So that's amazing. And then you actually brought it up, talked to your professor at the time. And
yeah. When I first thought of it, I thought it was sort of obvious, and I thought surely somebody's done this before. And so it took me a while to realize that that was not the case, that this was a new idea. And it's very exciting when you have new ideas that nobody's thought of before, but it doesn't happen that often. Most of the good ideas you have, somebody thought of them 10 or 100 years ago. Yeah.
Right. So it was really, I think it's just a thank you for explaining how you felt in that great moment. And it would seem that in the transactional interpretation of quantum physics, maybe there is no need for an observer. You know, some people might therefore conclude all possible advanced and retarded waves are interacting rather than primarily the most beneficial exchanges occurring. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is there seems to be some kind of a role for observers, and that's why people in physics want to keep putting it in there.
Well, my view is that it's a little like you can see a child swinging on a swing, watch the moon and the orbit, and you can describe the orbit of the moon in terms of the way the child swings back and forth on the swing, but that doesn't mean the child is causing the moon to move in its orbit. And it's a sort of the same way in quantum mechanics. The observer observes things that are there, but that doesn't mean that the observer, by the act of making an observation, is causing the wave function to do anything, that rather it's a consequence of the wave function doing something, not the cause of it. It's very easy to confuse cause and effect, and it's very easy to confuse the map with the territory. These are two mistakes that are made a lot in the area of the interpretation of quantum mechanics. But I think I've managed to avoid both of them.
Right. And I think you bring up a brilliant point when you're looking at the forward and backward through time effectiveness that quantum physics definitely is doing that. There definitely is a retrocausal effect. Then, like you point out, we can't afford to make mistakes in confusing cause and effect, but it's easy to do. And there's that kind of a bias that people tend to have with regard of causality, that we tend to look at relationships, assume that we know kind of what the motive is and what's going on. But actually, this transactional interpretation is showing us that it's all about relationships. There may be hierarchies within those relationships, but there's kind of it looks like you're looking right into the truth of this real reality, this ontological reality that is out there, and showing us a little bit more about it, which I think is fascinating. And obviously, this is just the beginning. I mean, this book is an invitation, as I see it, for people to join the conversation and take this theory more seriously. You pointed out in your book that a lot of textbooks don't really include transactional interpretation.
They don't include any interpretations in many cases. I think 12 or 13 different current textbooks on quantum mechanics, and in many cases they don't even mention the Copenhagen interpretation. The tendency to shut up and calculate has become the sort of the dominant approach to quantum mechanics. Yeah.
Yes, it's been a bit of a problem there because it seems obvious to me that, as you mentioned earlier, quantum computers are coming. We need to be clear on the logic that would run them, just as we had Boolean logic for classical computers. We're really going to need to figure out what this quantum logic is. And obviously, there will be logic gates that go forward and backward through time. That's the way quantum mechanics works. So I think it's going to be necessary for people to think, maybe I'm just hopeful, but I like people to really think about what's going on here.
Well, one of the advantages of the transactional interpretation is it allows you to visualize. I'm a very visual person, and I've always found it very difficult to think when things get so abstract I can't visualize them. And one of the things the transactional interpretation does is to allow you to visualize what's going on in these complicated quantum processes in ways that other interpretations of quantum mechanics prevent you from doing. The Copenhagen interpretation tells you that you're not supposed to ask questions about what goes on behind the scenes. And the quantum mechanics and the transactional interpretation raises the shade and allows you to watch what's going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. And I like the way that when you bring this kind of interpretation into fields like biology, for example, now I mentioned that we've been looking at quantum biology on this radio show. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at something like photosynthesis, or when you look at genetic changes and cognitive processes such as memory and decision-making, all these different areas seem like they're opening up to a much clearer, simpler explanation of quantum mechanics rather than previously held ideas. Do you have any thoughts on how the transactional interpretation might offer some advantages for biology?
I haven't worried very much about the quantum aspects of biology yet. They're certainly there. I mean, we're talking about systems that are small enough so that the quantum mechanics can get into the act. But I think that's an open field which is not very well explored yet. Exactly at what level does it become necessary to invoke quantum mechanics when trying to understand biological processes? So I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface in that area.
Very true. That's exactly right. Well, now I'd like to move into another area that it's near and dear to your heart, also mine, because when I was growing up, I read a lot of science fiction. I loved it. And in addition to making really important contributions to scientific research, you also write science fiction.
Yeah, I've written two what are called hard science fiction novels. In the late 80s, I wrote a novel called Twister, which is set at the University of Washington and involves a rather prosaic condensed matter experiment, which turns out to open the door to a sort of shadow matter version of the Earth, and et cetera. And in the late 90s, I wrote another science fiction novel called Einstein's Bridge, which is about high energy physics. And it's set. You may remember that they were building the superconducting supercollider in Waxahachie, Texas. During the Clinton administration, the Congress decided to cancel the project, which was a disaster to high energy physics and so forth. Well, my novel Einstein's Bridge describes what actually happened, which is that the supercollider got built. It unexpectedly sent interdimensional signals to other bubble universes and hostile aliens in one of these. Bubble universes established a wormhole connection to the super collider and ended up destroying the Earth. But a beneficial other species in the meantime had contacted physicists and used wormholes to send the physicists backwards in time to the Reagan administration, where they proceeded to manipulate the Reagan and Bush and Clinton administrations in order to get the project canceled and save the Earth. And it explains various other inexplicable phenomena, like how Dan Quayle became the vice president of the United States.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I love it. That's great.
And I have a informal, at the moment, nothing's been signed yet, but I have an arrangement with Tor Books to write a sequel to Einstein's Bridge, which I'm presently on chapter 12 of, and I'm working, and I expect that maybe next year there will be a sequel to Einstein's Bridge, which takes the story further.
I get a feeling of possible movie coming out of this. No, seriously.
Both of my books would make good movies, but nobody's ever been terribly interested in doing that. Somebody once commented, a Hollywood outfit once looked at Twister and decided the special effects would be too expensive.
Well, now that I think it's computer graphics is making things more possible, and there's a lot of interest.
There's a lot of cute six-legged animals in Twister, which I think would be make a wonderful movie. But anyway.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, what is it that you enjoy about writing fiction compared to writing nonfiction?
Well, when I first wrote Twister, I was the director of the University of Washington Nuclear Physics Laboratory, and we were in the middle of a project for building a booster to our tandem Van de Graaff that cost $10 million. It was a superconducting LINAC and a very fairly complicated project, and which we ended up completing on time and under budget. But we had various troubles along the way. And I found that writing science fiction was a good outlet for my frustrations while this construction project was going on, because I could make things work the way I wanted without having to cave into reality when things broke or hooks failed and things fell on the floor or one thing or another that happened during the construction of the LINAC. And so it was a wonderful outlet for me. When I wrote Einstein's Bridge, I had originally intended to write a novel based at the superconducting supercollider to be timed to come out about the time the machine went into operation, and there would be a lot of publicity about that, and my novel would be able to build on the publicity that the supercollider would get. And I was devastated when they canceled the project, because I had put a lot of work into laying out this novel, and that work was going down the rabbit hole, so to speak. And then a couple of years later, I was on sabbatical in Munich, and one morning in my funny German shower, I figured out how to fix the problem by making it into a time travel novel, and so that's how Einstein's Bridge came into effect. I could start out at the supercollider and then go backwards in time and cause the project to be canceled.
And some people actually had that theory that was going on when the Large Hadron Collider was being constructed, that something seemed to be stopping it.
Yes.
Lots of points.
Oh, there's a story by John Gribben about building a big machine, and it keeps failing, and they can't understand why. And finally, some bright theorist understands what's going on, which is that every time the machine comes on the air, it destroys the universe. So the only universes that are left are the ones in which the machine doesn't work. And,
right. Actually, there are a lot of conspiracy theorists who love this stuff. So, and I love the way that you get playful when you're looking at ideas and how to solve problems. I get the feeling that when you're working on the sequel to Einstein's Bridge, you just might solve that problem in non-local signaling. I mean, because then you're in a playful state of mind. It's not so serious, and it's like being a kid again.
Yes. Yeah, you can. Well, the way you write science fiction is that it's sort of like a gardener does with a tree. You take a plant that has very robust roots, and then you graft something on top to the root structure up above, which makes lovely flowers and so forth. And that's more or less what you do in science fiction. You use the roots of real science, and then you graft on ideas that may or may not be correct, but that are interesting and make for a good storyline. And that's the way I've done both of my novels.
And I think it's much better to read science fiction by a real scientist, because it's a lot less annoying than than trying to follow the logical reasoning of something where the science just seems.
Yeah, well, let me say something about those novels. They're both available at Bookview Cafe as ebooks, and Twister will be reprinted as a Dover reprint very soon, I think in about 6 months. And Einstein's Bridge is going to be reprinted as a book by Tor if and when I finish writing the sequel, which is probably about a year from now. Say a year to 2 years from now, the sequel to Einstein's Bridge and a reprint of it should be available from Tor Books.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for doing all of this science fiction writing in addition to coming up with a transactional interview.
Yeah, well, I should say that I also write a column in Analog Science Fiction magazine every other month. It's called The Alternate View, because I alternate with another guy. But and these are on the web. If you search on Kramer and Alternate View, you'll come across them. And there's about 180 of them on the web right now, many of which deal with quantum mechanics and other interesting aspects of physics.
Oh, that's great. And this is just another great way to stay in touch with you and find out what you're doing. Are there other ways that our audience can find out more about your work?
Well, my website is www.faculty.washington.edu/J. Kramer, J-C-R-A-M-E-R. And the website there contains links to my books, to my research, to various other things. And so if you want to know more about me and what I've done, that's probably a good way of doing it. One interesting thing there is that one of my alternate view columns was about a project at the South Pole, or where they were measuring the cosmic microwave background, and the people who were doing the experiment said that they were talking about the sound of the Big Bang, or they were measuring the sound of the Big Bang, and so I included that in my column. And I got a letter from a mother saying that her son, Jason, was going to give a talk. Was supposed to give a talk to his class about the Big Bang Theory, and he was wondering if they were wondering if the sound of the Big Bang had been recorded anywhere so he could play it for his class. And I sort of laughed about this. And then I began thinking about it and decided that the program Mathematica from Wolfram Research can actually convert mathematical functions into sound waves and sound files. And so I sat down and took the data from the WMAP experiment and made it into a sound file that reproduces the sound of the Big Bang. And this is one of the things that's on my website. When the Planck experiment worked later on, I did the same thing with better data from the Planck experiment, and both of these are available on my website. It's not the sound of the Big Bang sounds rather like an airplane flying low over your house in the middle of the night, to give you a sort of a preview of what's there.
Wow, that's really great. Oh, that's great. So people have something to look forward to. I do highly recommend people visit your website. And is there anything that you'd like to say in closing this extraordinary, wonderful interview?
Well, yeah, my book is just come out from Springer. I guess Amazon started selling it a couple of days ago. And it's called the Quantum Handshake, Entanglement, Nonlocality, and Transactions. And it's also available from the Springer website itself. You can pay for it in euros or dollars. I think it's actually a little cheaper in euros than dollars for some reason. But and it's it's available as both an ebook and as a paper book, and both of them are available from Springer and also from Amazon.
Well, Dr. Kramer, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show today, and thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to staying in touch with everything you're doing, because I think all of the work that you're mentioning today is extraordinary. Until next time, hope people join us on the next show of Living the Quantum Dream. Keep asking, how good can it get?
Thank you for listening to this edition of Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson of RealityShifters.com. Join Cynthia next time in visualizing and accessing whole new worlds of possibility on Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.